Today on Against the Grain, one component of BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, is the U.S. academic boycott of Israel. Sunaina Myra helped launch the movement for that boycott. I'm CS, the UC Davis professor who's written about the history, current status of, and opposition to the academic boycott, joins us coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It's been resisted, criticized, and condemned, but the U.S. academic boycott of Israel is still at it, generating support from around the U.S. 7 years ago, Sunaina Myra, a professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Davis, helped launch the U.S. academic and cultural boycott of Israel, working with a small group of scholars and activists who, she writes, felt a sense of urgency about Israel's genocidal violence and were concerned that the discourse of academic freedom was not enough to address the lockdown on criticism of the Israeli state in the academy. Sunaina Myra has written much more about the academic boycott, the challenges it's faced, and the often forgotten plight of Palestinian academics and students for a new volume. It's called Against Apartheid, the Case for Boycotting Israeli Universities. The focus of Sunaina's research and teaching is on Asian American youth culture, as well as social movements challenging militarization, imperialism, and settler colonialism. When Sunaina Myra joined me in studio, I asked her about the initial call made by Palestinians for an academic and cultural boycott of Israel.
That's a very important moment. In 2004, a group of Palestinian intellectuals and workers and activists in Palestine issued a call for an academic and cultural boycott of Israeli institutions. And they did so realizing that, in fact, all other measures seemed to have failed to end Israel's illegal military occupation. There had been a court ruling, actually, by the International Court of Justice, I believe, against the Israeli apartheid wall, as it's known. There were different campaigns that had been, you know, happening all around the world, but it seemed that Israel's impunity was incredibly obdurate. So they resorted to a strategy that had been used in the campaign to end South African apartheid, which is a campaign of actually trying to erode the legitimacy of Israel's cultural and academic institutions by asking academics, cultural workers, and community members worldwide not to participate or to collude with Israeli academic and cultural institutions until Israel adhere to three principles, which are the basic framework for the larger boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, or BDS movement in general. And if you don't mind, I will actually just note these because I think a lot of people may not be aware of this. And this is the kind of core, you know, paradigm or architecture of the academic and cultural boycott movement, which is that the boycott has to be maintained until Israel ends its occupation of all Arab lands and dismantles the wall. Second, it recognizes the fundamental rights of the Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality. And third, it respects and promotes the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes as stipulated by the United Nations.
So when the call is not to collude with academic and cultural institutions, what does that mean? What does collusion, as they thought about it and framed it, mean?
That's a very important question, actually. That's the key issue, which is that the call from the Palestinian Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, or PACB, was specifically for academics and cultural workers not to participate in events, conferences, festivals, or workshops that are sponsored or hosted by Israeli academic and cultural institutions. So the call was not a boycott of individual Israeli academics or artists. That's very important, and there's sometimes a lot of confusion about this. Sometimes there's been a deliberate obfuscation of this point that it's an institutional and not an individual boycott. So say, for example, there is a conference on Asian diasporas at Tel Aviv University. If I don't want to cross the BDS picket line or violate the boycott, then I would not, as a U.S. academic, participate in this institutional event at Tel Aviv University. I could, however, engage in a dialogue with those Israeli academics who are interested in Asian diaspora studies. I could even collaborate with one of them individually. But given that Israeli academic institutions have been consistently complicit with the occupation and have not actually challenged Israel's racist policies against its Palestinian citizens, it does make Israeli academic institutions in general, you know, complicit partners in upholding that racist regime. And furthermore, there has never been any kind of collective effort by Israeli academics to actually condemn Israeli state policies. There have been individual academics who have done so. So the locus, the focus of the PACB and then later on the U.S. and other global campaigns has been on Israeli academic institutions because they also provide a certain legitimacy for the Israeli regime. Any kind of, you know, self-professed liberal democratic state relies on its cultural institutions to shore up its global legitimacy. And that's a key reason why, as in the case of South Africa, it makes it very important to actually cut our ties with those institutions.
PACB being the Palestinian Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Could we say, though, that there are certain academic and cultural institutions in Israel who are that are less complicit in the policies of the Israeli government vis-a-vis the Palestinians and therefore perhaps should not be the target of an institutional boycott?
Right. I mean, I think that's an important question as well, and it's one that people ask. And I think, you know, the framework that PACB has provided, it has extensive and very detailed guidelines that, you know, actually have been developed after a lot of thought and a lot of kind of like ethical discussion and parsing out of what it actually means to be boycotting complicit institutions. It does actually include a clause that if an institution were, say, at some point to respect the human rights of Palestinians according to the framework that I just mentioned, then it would not be boycottable. So it's not a blanket or a sort of categorical boycott. It's actually a principled political boycott that is dependent or contingent on the social reality that actually, to this date, not only have Israeli academic institutions not actually respected the human rights of Palestinians and have participated in these apartheid policies, but they have actually enacted various forms of discrimination against them. So, you know, there is a small group of Israeli scholars and activists called Boycott From Within who actually respect the boycott and call for it, and they do so at great risk because, in fact, it is considered a legal offense in Israel to actually call for boycott. So it's clearly a space that is not, in fact, as democratic as some people think it is.
So now the U.S. Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel was formed in response to this call by the Palestinians in 2004. So how was the U.S. version of this boycott movement formed, and where did it first emerge?
So the U.S. movement in response to PACB's call, or the Palestinian call, was actually launched in 2009, in the winter of that year, in fact, in January, when Israel was engaging in its war on Gaza, which ended up, you know, killing, massacring over 1,500 Palestinians and destroying universities and school and devastating the Gaza Strip, which it continued to do, you know, repeatedly since then. At that time, in fact, there was a network called California Scholars for Academic Freedom, in which many scholars who were engaged with Middle East studies or concerned about Palestine were involved. I was one of them, and there were several others. And at that point, many of us just felt enough is enough. You know, this has actually been going on for a long time, this destruction of Palestinian, you know, land and life. And it was actually also a responsibility that we felt very acutely as taxpaying U.S.-based academics, meaning that, you know, U.S. taxes actually fund the Israeli occupation and its apartheid regime. Israel is a recipient of massive and unconditional U.S. aid. So we felt that, you know, there was something that needed to be done. And our Palestinian colleagues, Palestinian academics, had asked us to engage in boycott, which is actually a very small action, we felt, given the scale of Israel's actions and its ongoing war crimes. And so we actually decided to form a campaign that would institutionalize support for the Palestinian call in a way that had not been done so far, which meant that we actually sent out a call to endorse the Palestinian academic and cultural boycott to U.S. academics and to cultural workers. And we created a website where people could actually learn about the academic and cultural boycott and where they could actually sign on. And I have to say that, you know, there was so much resistance at that time to making a call for academic and cultural boycott, and specifically, I would say, the academic boycott. There had already been some campaigns focused on divestment. There had been some campaigns focused on consumer boycott, including here in the Bay Area, you know, Rainbow Co-op. There have been other kinds of grassroots efforts. But in fact, there's been so much resistance in the academy to challenging this normalized status that Israel has as an exceptional state that is above critique of its human rights violations. So it was really a struggle.
Tell me more about the resistance from academic circles and academic institutions and academics to the, you know, the initial launch of the U.S. academic and cultural boycott of Israel.
The initial resistance was actually, you know, for many of us very familiar, but it was still incredibly disturbing because it was in the midst of this massacre, as I said, and some of the responses that we got from other academics were, it was not the right time. You know, it's never the right time, it seems, to call for justice in Palestine. I mean, one could say the same about South Africa. One could say the same about slavery, perhaps. When is a good time? The second was that it was actually not strategic. And I think underlying this resistance and this anxiety was a clear fear, I think, of the repercussions that people knew would actually ensue if we were to call for a boycott of Israeli academic institutions from those who have long defended Israel and who have enjoyed a certain, I would say actually exceptional space of being above critique in the U.S. academy. For a long time in the U.S. university, Palestine has basically been the third rail of academic discourse. Academics all know or all have known that you must not criticize Israel if you want to keep your job, if you want to get tenure, if you want to get promoted, if you want to have a fellowship, or get a postdoc. And in fact, it's this kind of tacit knowledge or common knowledge, and sometimes it's very explicit. You know, graduate students are actually told, don't do a dissertation on Palestine if you want to get a PhD and get a job afterwards, you know. So I think that, you know, structure of repression within the academy is one that people were very hesitant to challenge. And the academic boycott directly targets the lockdown on open discussion of Palestine and Israel in the U.S. academy that has existed for many decades, but which I think the academic boycott movement has really helped erode.
Sunaina Myra joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. She is professor of Asian American Studies at University of California, Davis, and she helped launch the U.S. academic and cultural boycott of Israel. She contributed an essay entitled The Ghosts That Haunt Us, The U.S. Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel and the Settler University to the volume Against Apartheid, The Case for Boycotting Israeli Universities. It's edited by Ashley Dawson and Bill Mullen and published by Haymarket Books. So in other words, because I thought you were going to say the resistance to this organizing around an academic boycott came from Zionist groups, Zionist organizations, but you are saying that progressives, people who believe in the struggle for Palestinian justice, were hesitant to embrace the call for a, specifically an academic boycott.
Yes, I mean, I'm glad you did mention, you know, Zionist resistance as well, because clearly there was Zionist resistance. And in fact, you know, I think for a long time, you know, Zionists believed that there would never be a boycott or even a divestment movement in the U.S. And I do want to make it clear that when we launched the boycott, the response from, you know, Israeli sort of policy institutions, sort of strategic planning institutions and think tanks in Israel was basically that it was a strategic, if not an existential threat. I mean, there were actually documents that were issued in which there was clear evidence that, you know, Zionists in Israel, as well as their partners in the U.S., were extremely anxious and felt very threatened by the rise of the BDS movement. The academic boycott in particular had always been considered unthinkable. And I think there was a certain sort of privilege that Zionist academics have enjoyed in the U.S. university that they felt would never be shaken, I think progressive academics occupied this very awkward and precarious position where, you know, there's a sort of common saying in the Palestine Solidarity in the U.S., another acronym, which is PEP, which is Progressive Except on Palestine. And it's a very unfortunate acronym, but it exists and it indicates a reality in which, you know, as I found in my years in the U.S. Academy, people who might be progressive and engaged in environmental justice, in queer rights, in feminist activism, in labor movements, simply would not take a stand on justice for Palestinians. And so I think it's that contradiction, that paradox that the BDS movement and the academic boycott movement specifically exposed. And I think that the anxiety amongst liberal and progressive academics was in large part based on the fear of the backlash that they knew would actually unfold, given that there are very well-funded and powerful Zionist groups and lobby organizations in the U.S. that do, in fact, target academics who dare to criticize Israel.
And which Zionist groups and organizations are we talking about?
You know, there's so many of them and they evolve over time. But I think most recently, and I think I mentioned this in the essay too, the ones that have been very active are AMCA, or the AMCHA initiative, which is in fact based here in the Bay Area, sadly, and has organized some really vicious campaigns of defamation, smear campaigns, and also legislative campaigns, in fact, targeting Palestinian rights movements in the academy, students and academics. There's also the Israel on Campus Coalition. It's very interesting that one of the key players in the academic freedom movement, a former president of the American Association of University Professors, Carrie Nelson, is actually very active in this. And there is also the Zionist Organization of America and the Anti-Defamation League, or the ADL, which many liberals and progressives, again, have not been aware that, in fact, the ADL, for all its sort of professed civil rights and human rights advocacy, is actually a pretty hardcore Zionist organization that has also been engaged in intervening in campuses and violating academic freedom of those who advocate for Palestinian rights. There are several other organizations, by the way, but I think that, you know, these players in general tend to work in a concerted campaign nationally as well as internationally. And in fact, they also get funding from the Israeli government, which has responded to the growing success of the BDS movement by actually, you know, throwing millions of shekels or dollars in what's called a Brand Israel campaign or Hasbara or propaganda campaigns to try to counter this movement. So it's pretty serious business.
The American Studies Association. So this is a scholarly association, I'm reading here, devoted to the interdisciplinary study of U.S. culture and history in a global context. And many universities have American Studies departments. What stance did the ASA, the American Studies Association, take on the academic and cultural boycott question in 2013?
The ASA took a historic and really courageous stance on the question of Palestine in general in 2013. It became the first academic association, actually in North America, to support the academic boycott of Israel. The resolution that was adopted by the American Studies Association was one in which several of my colleagues who were organizing around the academic boycott were involved. And in fact, it was supported by the vast majority of the members of the American Studies Association. There was a historic town hall meeting at the ASA conference in Washington, D.C., that year, in which it was clear that the tide had really changed in the U.S. Academy. And this was actually something that was so eye-opening, including for those of us who had been working in the trenches in Palestine solidarity activism for a long time, because we realized that, in fact, the terrain had shifted. Like, literally, the ground had, you know, shifted under our feet, and that there was just this groundswell of support for Palestinian rights. And I think what also came to our attention was that a lot of the support was from scholars, from graduate students and faculty in ethnic studies, critical race studies, feminist and queer studies, particularly indigenous and settler colonial studies, post-colonial studies, And in fact, what was really kind of, you know, given my sort of frustrations that I indicated earlier with the PEP phenomenon, Progressive Acceptance Palestine, it was becoming clear that Palestine was becoming a progressive cause, that to be progressive, one, you know, to be consistent, had to support, you know, human rights or justice for Palestinians as well. So I think that the ASA resolution was not just about the American Studies Association. It was indicative of this larger transformation of the discourse around Palestine and the politics related to this issue in the U.S. Academy.
And there was also that year a boycott resolution passed by the Association of Asian American Studies and also the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association also passed a resolution. So when you're talking about a fundamental shift, a transformation, are you saying that in some ways the paradigm within academic institutions in the U.S. had changed such that advocating for Palestine and Palestinian rights would no longer make you persona non grata?
Yeah, you know, that's a complicated question, and I think it's one that several of the essays in the book reflect on as well. I want to just go back to the observation that you made about the Association of Asian American Studies, and I'm really glad you noted that because, in fact, I should correct myself slightly to the extent that, in fact, the Association of Asian American Studies was the first professional academic association outside the Arab world, not just in the United States or North America, to adopt the academic boycott. It was in April of 2013, so it was actually a few months before the American Studies Association. And what's very significant about this is that there was a unanimous vote amongst the Asian Americanists present at the national conference that year in support of the academic boycott. It really took everybody by surprise, including especially Zionists who were not expecting this. And, you know, I think that that was also a sign of the changing times in which I think in critical ethnic studies in particular, given the anti-racist and anti-imperial history of Asian American studies, I think scholars really was sort of a no-brainer, you know, when presented with the question. And I think presented with the question in a context that was pretty much free of Zionist intervention or pressure. I think that's very important to note that in the Association of Asian American Studies, there is not necessarily a Zionist presence as there is, say, in the Middle East Studies Association or perhaps even, you know, in the American Anthropological Association or other academic associations. So it was really smooth sailing for that resolution, and it was spearheaded by a group of scholars, including a South Asian and Indian American academic who had in fact visited me in Palestine a few months earlier. And when she visited me in Ramallah, where I was staying at the time, she was so moved and shocked by what she saw that she went back to the U.S. determined to organize with the Association of Asian American Studies. And I think for me, this is something I'm very proud of as someone who also works in Asian American Studies, that I think that, you know, that really was a moment when the field, I think, lived up to its foundational, you know, promise of being a movement for social and global justice.
Who was that scholar?
So, we should mention her by name. So it's actually my colleague and friend, Rajni Srikant, who is at the University of Massachusetts, UMass Boston, and who teaches in Asian American Studies there. And it was also several other scholars in Asian American Studies, including from the Critical Filipino and Filipina Studies Collective, who've also had a history of anti-war, you know, activism.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Sunaina Myra joins us. She teaches Asian American Studies at UC Davis. Her books include Desi's in the House, Indian American Youth Culture in New York City, and Missing, Youth, Citizenship, and Empire After 9/11. She also co-edited with Pia Chatterjee the volume The Imperial University, Academic Repression and Scholarly Dissent. And on top of all that, she contributed an essay about the academic boycott of Israeli universities to the new volume Against Apartheid, The Case for Boycotting Israeli Universities. So we have these resolutions from, among other associations, the Association of Asian American Studies and the American Studies Association. What did these resolutions do to at least some of the resistance to the academic boycott, and what kinds of campaigns were spawned from those actions?
I think this is really the crux of the matter, CS. I think that, in fact, what those resolutions did, apart from actually taking a certain position on formal collaboration or connection with Israeli academic institutions was to open up intellectual and political space within these fields. And I think it legitimized or normalized a more open and critical discourse related to Israel and Palestine, related to U.S. policies in connection to the Israeli state and the Palestinian occupation and to the region, as well as to, the ways in which anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian racism has been embedded in, U.S. mainstream culture. And so in all of these associations, I think what it did was it actually allowed people to come forth into the open and to talk more freely, to organize panels. In fact, in the ASA, there was a profusion of panels related to the place of Palestine in American studies around that time. And the same is true of other associations. In terms of the resistance, I mean, there was a horrendous campaign of backlash that unfolded, as soon as the resolution was adopted, but also in the months preceding it. So there was a heavy campaign of pressure on the American Studies Association. There were legal threats, there were financial threats, there were political threats. So there were basically forms of blackmail where, people were really subjected to this really vicious torrent of individual smear campaigns against particular academics and leaders in ASA, as well as threats against the association. I mean, I think what was very striking for me, and this is something I reflected on in this chapter as well, is that the campaigns were framed in an overtly racist and sometimes actually homophobic language, because the leadership of the American Studies Association by this point has become largely, in fact, reflective of the shifts in the field, which is that the leaders tend to be scholars of color, racial minorities, queer scholars, feminist and indigenous scholars. And in fact, I think what was really troubling was the ways in which we could see that the sort of Zionist consensus was converging with a certain conservative consensus. And I think, in fact, exposing that has been very important, given what I mentioned earlier about this liberal Zionist or kind of like left Zionist politics that permeates so many social movements in the U.S. And in my view, I've always felt that that should be a contradiction. You can't be a leftist and a Zionist or progressive and a Zionist, contrary to, certain claims that are made in Israel. But I think sort of, seeing the cracks within that, was very important. So there were actually campaigns in different state legislatures around the country, and there were also several university presidents that issued a statement basically condemning the boycott, threatening faculty if they decided to support the ASA's boycott. But basically, none of those campaigns survived or were successful. And in fact, what we saw was a spate of resolutions in different academic associations, one after the other in the following years.
So you've referred a lot to race already in relation to what's happening in Israel and Palestine. I think when a lot of people think about Israel, they think of occupation, they think of repression, or they think of colonization. And yet, the U.S. academic and cultural boycott of Israel, which you helped launch, says or states, as you indicate in your essay in this book, Against Apartheid, that this campaign, this movement, has a specifically anti-racist focus. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, that is a really important point, and it's one that I feel very strongly about, because I think that the effectiveness of the boycott as a tool to challenge Zionism actually rests on the fact that there is an important anti-racist challenge waged in the work of the U.S. academic and cultural boycott campaign. And I go on to say that there has long been an uneasy and ambivalent relationship to the repressed race politics of settler colonialism in Israel, Palestine, amongst U.S. scholars. And what I mean by this is that while, as you just pointed out, there is a critique, and I think this critique has been growing, especially among students, of the Israeli occupation, I don't think that the discourse of anti-racism has been as powerfully wedded to this critique as it should. And I think that that is because of the lack of an anti-colonial politics that can actually view Zionism as a racist and settler colonial ideology or program. The absence of an anti-Zionist discourse, sometimes even within Palestine solidarity activism, ironically, is, I think, one of the roots of this problem. one of the other problems, and I think it's something that one has to put on the table, it's sort of the elephant in the room in some sense, is the question of anti-Semitism. So the problem is that, you know, for a long time in the U.S., you know, open debate about Israel-Palestine has been suppressed by viewing any critique of the state of Israel, of Israeli state policies, as automatically anti-Semitic. And this has been an alibi for basically, you know, repressing, censoring, and defaming any kind of, you know, scholarly critique or activist sort of organizing in support of Palestinians. What it has done is basically, in a sense, to also, you know, weld the entire Jewish community to kind of automatic allegiance also to the state of Israel by suggesting that if you challenge Israeli state policies, you're anti-Semitic. So I think the problem is that, you know, Zionists have used the strategy of casting any criticism of the state of Israel as being racist because it's, you know, inherently anti-Semitic, even if it's specifically, you know, in a progressive language of human rights or anti-colonialism, anti-racism, and so on. And so there's this very strange move that happens, which is that there is a movement that is actually trying to call for racial equality and an end to racial violence in Israel-Palestine. But this anti-racist movement gets called racist. And I think this obfuscation, you know, is so problematic. I mean, when one breaks it down, it seems very clear that it's paradoxical. But it has actually been successful for a very, very long time. And I think that is because of the genuine concerns of many people about anti-Semitism that has made them very sensitive to this issue. But I think the Zionist lobby's use of this alibi for repression has started to break down because you now also have progressive anti-Zionist Jewish Americans and Jewish Israelis who are basically calling this out, calling their bluff, and pointing out that it is in fact not in any sense anti-Semitic to criticize Israel. In fact, there are scholars who argue that not to criticize Israel might incite anti-Semitism because in fact it's, you know, wedding the Jewish people to a particular project that not all of them, in fact, support. And so I think, you know, my concern has always been that there is an inability in the U.S. in particular, not in other countries. I have actually lived and taught in other places in the world in which people are shocked when they hear about, you know, the rhetoric that is used in the United States. It's so foreign to them. But I think that that problem is entangled with a particular situation in which people cannot also name anti-Palestinian racism. It's very difficult in the United States to talk about anti-Arab racism. It's the missing ism, you know, as I sometimes say to my students. And it's a problem of Orientalism. It goes back to Edward Said's work on Palestine being the last taboo in U.S. mainstream culture. But, you know, basically what I'm trying to say is that I think the BDS movement has really helped, you know, expose and unpack these contradictions, which I think is very productive.
Sunaina Myra is her name. She teaches Asian American Studies at UC Davis. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with her about her work within the academic and cultural boycott of Israel movement in the U.S. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Sunaina Myra joins us in our Berkeley studios. She is professor of Asian American Studies at University of California, Davis. Her name is spelled S-U-N-A-I-N-A. Last name Myra, M-A-I-R-A. And she contributed an essay about the U.S. academic and cultural boycott of Israel. and the what she calls the Settler University to the volume Against Apartheid, The Case for Boycotting Israeli Universities. We have a link to that book and to Sunaina's faculty page at UC Davis on our website, againstthegrain.org. So, Sunaina, one of the purposes of your essay in this volume, Against Apartheid, is to center, to recenter the Palestinian academic, scholar, student, and what they are actually experiencing. Because there's all this noise around the discourse and debate within the U.S. and the controversy around boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and specifically the academic boycott. So give us a sense of what Palestinian academics and students are experiencing and enduring, both within Israel and in the occupied territories.
Right. I mean, since we were speaking about, you know, Palestinians within Israeli state borders, within the 1948 borders, you know, let's first start with that. I mean, what's really kind of astounding is the ways in which the Palestinian right to education is violated within Israel. So a very, very tiny fraction of Palestinians within Israel who are citizens of the Israeli state manage to go to get into higher education. Very small percentage end up going on to do doctoral degrees, and even fewer Palestinians are really just, you know, a handful of them practically who end up being academics. And they are blocked because they are actually educated in racially segregated Palestinian Arabic language schools. They don't get access to the same kinds of college scholarships that other Israeli citizens do. And when they get to college, again, Israeli academic institutions are incredibly discriminatory against Palestinian students, again, in a host of domains. So when it comes to, for example, political activism, contrary to the image that we have that Israel is this democratic space in which, you know, academic freedom flourishes and political freedom is alive and well, Palestinian students are often officially barred by universities from engaging in political activism. Their activism tends to be related to their Palestinian identities and concerns and the community issues. They're labeled traitors if they try to challenge Israel's wars. In many cases, there have been physical assaults and death threats and really ugly forms of racism against Palestinian students. So the community itself, in general, of Palestinian academics, as I said, is incredibly vulnerable. And they are, you know, in this kind of really impossible situation as indigenous people who are living within their own, living on their own land, but don't have access to the university. So one of my concerns is always that when we talk about Israeli scholars, we should not forget that there are also Palestinian scholars, you know, a few of them, and there are others who are trying to really sort of be able to break down the walls to enter the Israeli university.
Yeah, and I want to read something written by Majid Shihadeh, another contributor to this book, Against Apartheid. Shihadeh was a faculty member at Bereshit University in the occupied West Bank. He now teaches at UC Davis, and I found out just when we first met before we began the interview that he is, in fact, your spouse. But he writes in this volume, because his essay is about his personal experience as well as his political views. He writes, one could also tell a personal story, this is his, about making a trip to the university because the Office of Admissions would not return a call or respond to a letter about the status of one's application, and on the way to the university, being dragged out of the bus by Israeli soldiers who told the bus driver to continue the trip, being humiliated and belittled as an Arab going to the university, left in the open air afterward, not knowing where one is. One could also describe how, after receiving the best grades in the region where one grew up and scoring high grades on the National Israeli Exam, not being allowed to pursue certain subjects at the university, one was allowed to study only Arabic and Middle Eastern history, in quotes. And as an introductory course, all students had to take a class on Arab nationalism. In that class, we were told by the Israeli professor that we were not Arabs and that we would pass the class only if we wrote accordingly on the final exam. One could write about how on campus Arabs are monitored and surveilled upon entry and exit to and from campus and housing, or about repression of political dissent on campus. So there's a lot of stuff going on relating to Palestinian students, Palestinian academics within Israeli state borders. So talk about now what's going on within Palestinian universities in Gaza and the West Bank and the students who attend these universities.
Right. I mean, within the Palestinian sort of occupied territories or the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, you see ongoing degradation of the right to education. So Palestinian students have to encounter numerous obstacles to get to their universities due to the restrictions on freedoms of movement. Palestinian universities and colleges have been closed for very long periods of time during the Second Intifada. In the Gaza Strip, of course, Palestinian universities have been bombed, sometimes repeatedly, so literally a kind of destruction of Palestinian higher education. And in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, one of the things that is also really problematic is that, you know, Palestinian scholars also are not allowed to travel freely. So they're not allowed to leave the region if they want to go to conferences, because their freedom of travel is basically controlled by the Israeli state, which can decide at the last moment if they will give them a visa or not in order to leave the country. Students who want to go abroad to study, say from Gaza, given that universities keep getting bombed every couple of years, are often denied fellowships, sometimes even fellowships that were awarded by the United States and the Fulbright program for students from Gaza. They've been blocked by Israel. There's also what I found when I was living in the West Bank that was very frustrating to me as an academic, was something really basic that we take for granted here in our academic profession, which is access to books. It's very difficult to get access to research literature in Palestine. And I found that, you know, when I was actually spending time at a university, in fact, in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds University in Abu Dis, which is now actually on the other side of the wall, the Israeli apartheid wall, I found that students really barely read books. They just don't have access to something that we really take for granted, notwithstanding electronic books and so on. So there is really a kind of erosion of higher education in Palestine. And when I was working and talking to scholars from Bir Zeit and also to Palestinian students and scholars inside Israel, it really struck me that the problem is really that the academic freedom of Palestinians has really been degraded. And people do not talk about this enough when we constantly frame our debate around the question of the academic freedom of Israeli scholars.
Right, that's been a focus of the anti-boycott movement, right, to say that an academic boycott will harm the academic freedom of Israeli scholars. And could you remind us what academic freedom means again?
Right. So academic freedom is the freedom to be able to pursue one's academic work, you know, without restrictions and obstacles. And the scenario that I just described of Palestinian scholars and students shows that there has been a systematic assault on their academic freedom by Israel. Now, under the circumstances, you know, sort of within the framework of the academic boycott, there is actually no prohibition on Israeli scholars as individuals going to conferences, collaborating with academics who support the boycott, even co-authoring articles, doing research projects together, engaging in dialogue, visiting with one another. So this is simply, you know, I think an obfuscation of the question, the charge that Israeli scholars' academic freedom will be degraded or that it's a closing down of dialogue. And the campaigns that have been waged for a call to academic boycott in the Modern Language Association, the MLA, and the American Anthropological Association have run up against, you know, this kind of sort of obfuscation, which is there's not necessarily a charge anymore that the boycott is anti-Semitic, because people realize by now that argument is just ludicrous. And it's been challenged also by so many Jewish anti-Zionist academics. But it's also kind of resorting to these other kinds of arguments about academic freedom. And so in this sense, I think one of the points that is made in my essay is a point by a Palestinian scholar who talks about how one cannot also forget about freedom in general, that one cannot elevate academic freedom above human freedom at large. So the right of human beings, if we believe that human beings should have human freedoms, the limited sort of area of academic freedom that might come into question in terms of conferences at Israeli institutions and so on cannot be at the expense of the freedom of an entire population of humans.
Sunaina Myra joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm CS. She teaches Asian American Studies at UC Davis. And the book that we are talking about that she contributed an essay to is called Against Apartheid, The Case for Boycotting Israeli Universities. It's edited by Ashley Dawson and Bill Mullen. It's published by Haymarket Books. And Sunaina has been very active. In fact, she helped launch the U.S. academic and cultural boycott of Israel. Okay, so we have this academic boycott, which again is targeting Israeli academic and cultural institutions rather than individuals, on the theory that institutions in Israel are complicit with the Israeli government's racist and repressive treatment of Palestinians. The question does arise then what impact the academic boycott has had in Israel and in the occupied territories. So speaking about the academic institutions in Israel, the universities and colleges in Israel, does the academic boycott, can it claim to have made a difference in the way, for example, Palestinian students are treated or in the way that these academic institutions behave?
That is really an important question, and it's one that I have tried to address in this essay because I think sometimes there is an argument that is made that the academic boycott is purely symbolic. And for example, in the case of the American Studies Association, some of the so-called progressives countered us by basically sort of alleging that this really would not make too much of a difference to Palestinians. It was the wrong tactic. And so in writing this essay, I actually interviewed some Palestinian scholars and students, and I asked them, you know, what differences had made. And I want to just cite one young Palestinian student from Haifa inside Israel who basically told me, I believe the boycott movement around the world has a big impact on Israeli universities' decisions regarding punishing Palestinian students for protesting within the campus and other activities. And what she was alluding to was the fact that given that Palestinian students are routinely disciplined if they engage in activism on Israeli campuses, that in fact, the growing spotlight on Israeli universities has meant that administrators are now a little bit more wary about these sort of coercive and kind of excessive disciplinary measures because they know that now, you know, the eyes of the world are on them. And so for her, it mattered a great deal as a Palestinian student activist. There was also a Palestinian scholar from Bir Zeit University in the West Bank who I spoke to, who said that the academic boycott resolutions in the United States put pressure on the Israeli academy, which is the first step in alerting this academy that the world is not going to accept its role in repressing the Palestinians. I also interviewed an academic in Gaza who said the impact was huge in Palestine, in Gaza in particular, because it became clear that a taboo has been shaken in the U.S. And you know, CS, when I've been in Palestine and I've talked to people, there's such a painful sense amongst Palestinians that they feel the world has forgotten them. And there's a real sense of helplessness and a real sense of frustration and disappointment. And so I think these actions by American academics are a very powerful message of solidarity as well, that, you know, people, particularly those who are encaged in Gaza and the West Bank, who cannot leave, who cannot get out, who cannot actually meet and talk to colleagues and other people, you know, basically understand and become aware that, in fact, there is, you know, sort of surge of solidarity. Also, in the case of the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, I think, who cannot get out, one of the things that I do want to highlight is that along with the boycott, which is basically a measure of withdrawal of complicity, as Martin Luther King famously, you know, once said, that, you know, if one wants to also take a position for justice, sometimes one just has to end one's complicity with a form of injustice. But I think there's also been an attempt by American academics and students to travel to Palestine, given that Palestinians cannot often leave this prison-like sort of architecture of the occupation. And so we've seen numerous delegations increasingly. That's another interesting phenomenon, that have been traveling to Palestine over the years. I myself and my partner Majid, in fact, organized one such delegation in 2011 that led to the ASA boycott campaign, in as much as, in fact, the group of academics who we invited to come to Palestine ended up being the ones who spearheaded the boycott resolution in the ASA. Bill Mullen was one of those, and there were several other scholars of American studies as well.
So how big is the U.S. academic and cultural boycott of Israel today, and how many people have signed on and publicly supported its work?
At this point, we have about 1,200, 1,200 academic endorsers of the academic and cultural boycott. We have several hundred cultural workers who have signed the academic and cultural boycott, you know, by which I mean artists, filmmakers, journalists, poets, musicians, performers. And, you know, I have to say that, you know, when one steps back and thinks about it, that's actually a very small number, right? In a country like the United States, this is something that people are often surprised by, but I think it's in the context that we discussed earlier. There is still this hesitation about public support for the boycott. I think there are many thousands more who probably privately support it. And there are some who also, frankly, don't know about the academic and cultural boycott campaign, but who on principle would probably support it. Now, having said that, you know, when US ACBI, or the Academic and Cultural Boycott Campaign, was first launched, there was actually a report from the Reut Institute, which is a government-affiliated think tank in Israel that does a lot of strategic and defense policy discussion and reports. And they issued a report that said if the academic and cultural boycott garnered 500 supporters, it would be a strategic threat to Israel. So I think we're now a triple strategic threat to Israel by that calculation.
There are so many other aspects of this topic, among them the issue of U.S. academics being punished by universities in the U.S. for their pro-Palestinian views and statements and activism. But fortunately, you can read about that issue and many, many other issues in the volume, in the new volume, Against Apartheid, The Case for Boycotting Israeli Universities, to which Sunaina Myra, my guest, has contributed an essay. She's professor of Asian American Studies at UC Davis. Her books include Desi's In the House, Indian American Youth Culture in New York City, and Missing, Youth, Citizenship, and Empire After 9/11, and she also co-edited the volume The Imperial University, Academic Repression and Scholarly Dissent. Sunaina Myra, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show and giving me this opportunity to talk about this work.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.